All right, how many of us have ever wrestled or struggled with the concept of the providential rule of God? I was talking to somebody just the other day who was telling me about things that had happened in his life, and then looking back on it, he could see how it worked out like it should. On the other hand, when we're in the middle of things that involve the wider scope of the world and God's rule over His creation and God's rule over His moral government of the nations, this can get to be a very, very puzzling and difficult thing. So if you think with us for a second about how the line of thought has progressed in Habakkuk, it starts out with him looking at his city and his country, which would be Jerusalem and Judah, and he sees violence and iniquity and wrongdoing and strife and contention, just like watching the news almost. And he cries out, if you remember, the law is paralyzed, the wicked surround the righteous, justice goes forth perverted. So why, God, do you sit idly and look at wrong? You ever wondered that? So God's answer to that first question was, I'm working a work. And what was the work that he revealed that he's working? He's bringing the Babylonians to administer justice to Judah and Jerusalem. I'm working a work, and you wouldn't believe it if I told you. And he told Habakkuk, and what was Habakkuk's response? All right, that's not what I meant. You're right, I don't believe it. And more particularly, his question, if you remember, his question develops, look, you're of purer eyes than to behold iniquity. You can't look at wrong, chapter 1, verse 13. So how can you use the more wicked to punish the one more righteous than he is? And what's God's answer to that question? You're going to have to live by faith. You're going to have to wait and see, and you're going to have to let this unfold as I will for it to, as it's going to. And then that leads to the God's reassurance to Habakkuk, the people who do the wrong are going to account for it themselves. If you remember the woes, the sorrow of that we read last week from Habakkuk chapter 2 and verses 5 and following, the series of five of these, which ended simply with saying, the Lord's in His holy temple, let all the earth keep silence before Him. And that kind of brings us to where we are now. How has Habakkuk's faith matured or grown or developed in the middle of this discussion between his complaints and God's answers? And have Habakkuk's questions all been answered? Has God explained Himself to Habakkuk's satisfaction? Is it all now going to be easy for Habakkuk to accept God's rule of the world? No, none of that has happened. What has happened is Habakkuk has gotten to the place where he can say, God is God, and I'm not. And he can go ahead with it in that way. And a big part of the story happens here in Habakkuk 3. This is a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet. Notice chapter 3, verse 1. It doesn't all sound like a prayer. Part of it is a confession. It's a prayer which begins with a request and then spends a long time looking at what God has done in the history of His people thus far. And Habakkuk kind of finds his place in the story that way. So look at Habakkuk 3 and verse 2, and there are three things, or two or three things here in this passage that kind of set the stage. O Lord, I have heard the report of you and your work. Your work, O Lord, do I fear. What does he mean by that? Is he afraid now for God to be God? He's in awe of it. All right, so you start out, how can you look at this? And God says, this is what I'm going to do. And this says, how can you do that? And God says, at some point, Habakkuk, you're going to have to live by faith. And now Habakkuk is kind of getting to the point where he can see that this is an awesome thing that God is doing. And that it would require in order for justice to be administered in the world. So here are the things. There's kind of a past and a present and a future part of this. I just mentioned we won't dwell on this too long. So look at the past, present, and future aspect of this that comes up just in this one verse. I've heard the report of you. There's the past part of this. Then, your work do I fear. That's going to be the present part of this. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. Here comes the future part of this. In wrath, remember mercy. What is Habakkuk asking? That's his request. The request in this are revive your work now in the midst of the years, make it known, and then in wrath, remember mercy. What does he mean by that last phrase, in wrath, remember mercy? All right. What part of Habakkuk's prayer so far has required wrath? What part of his prayer is it that wrath is the only answer that could be given? Well, the evil. All right, the evil in the land. Then what would happen with the Babylonians, and then the series of woe on evil that happens in chapter 2. Why would he say, remember mercy? He started out praying for justice. Why is he now saying, in your justice, remember mercy? All right, when those things happen in that series of woes in chapter 3, or chapter 2 rather, if there's no mercy in it, here's what I think. I think Habakkuk has realized how far are we going to go with this, and I'll be in this story too, and I think he realizes now his need for his own mercy, his own need for mercy. Don't you? Don't you and I realize that? We pray for justice, it has to be, but in your wrath, remember mercy. So ultimately, how does God answer Habakkuk's prayer? I mean, way on down the line, how does God ultimately extend both wrath and mercy? What's the ultimate? How can you do both? Say it louder. All right, in particular, what about Jesus? The cross. Where judgment against sin occurs, and yet, in the middle of that, the Lord said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. So, ultimately, wrath and mercy are extended in the gospel. We read Romans 1 in our Bible reading. And there he starts talking about the gospel, which is the power of God to salvation. But then the wrath of God is revealed against all ungodliness and unrighteousness. So there's mercy and there's wrath. And that's the theme of Romans in a very big way too. So, all right, so now then, he's asked God to revive his work in the midst of the years and make it known. And here's the way it develops. And this is a This is a picture, a poetical picture of God's coming to revive his work in the midst of the years. And it's the way Habakkuk describes God's coming to the aid of his people is to look back at the way God has done it before and then to picture it as a big storm approaching. This is like you're watching the radar here. You're watching God arise off there to the south and the southeast of where Habakkuk lived. Big storm clouds come, and then God comes to the aid of his people. So watch the way he describes it. And this is in the past now. I've heard of your work. I've heard the report of you and of your work. God came from Teman and the Holy One from Mount Paran. To the southeast of the Dead Sea region where the wilderness was, there was Edom. And then these two areas are connected with Edom off there to the southeast. This is the area where the Mount Paran is the area near Sinai. This is where Elijah went when he was discouraged, sat under the juniper tree, wanted to just die. You remember that? And this is that area. God came from Teman. So here is, we'll kind of watch this happen here. Here is God's approach. And like this storm that we described, and God, the power of it, the wonder of God's approach, the awesome part of it, his splendor covered the heavens and the earth was full of his praise. There are passages in the Psalms like 102, for example, or Psalm 104 that are much like this. But the idea would be you can see in the middle, where Habakkuk has been looking at the evil in the land, and then at the greater evil in the nations, now what's his attention focused on? His attention is beginning to be focused on God. When in your life does attention turn away from what's going on around town, or what's going on in the world, and to God and what God has done to come to the aid of his people? When does that exercise happen in your life? When bad things are happening, Ruth? In prayer time, her prayer time, she said. When else? What about today? What will happen today that will kind of turn our attention toward God instead of the things that are going on in the world around us? The Lord's Supper would be the most powerful evidence of this, I think. So here, verse 4, now his brightness was like the light. So this is, let me say it a different way so you can kind of see the development. Here is God arising, and then second, here is God's approaching. These won't all start with A, but you can see what maybe Habakkuk is describing for us. So now then, verse 5, his brightness was like the light, rays flashed from his hand, and there he veiled his power. What picture kind of comes to your mind in verse 4 when rays flashed from his hand? All right, sunrise, the rays of sunrise, like this is like the light arising. Some people think it's like the lightning. I think of that when I read this, and the power behind it is veiled, but it's obvious. All right, now before him comes the two, what one writer calls the two dogs of war, which are pestilence and plague. Before him went pestilence and plague followed at his heels. What is pestilence? All right, it'd be disease. And then A plague would be disease as well. So these are both destructive, and both of them are illustrative of things that make human beings feel their smallness and helplessness, and which make us aware of how dependent we are on things. I saw the other day someone had this placard which said thoughts and prayers, and some political person had marked through it and put policies and change. Well, here are things that policies can't change and people can't do anything about, and there are extremes that don't really belong in the picture of God's people. Not thoughts and prayers, but prayers and actions. Prayers and deeds. That's the middle ground between that God's people stand on. All right, now verse 6 is where we are. He stood and measured the earth. He looked and shook the nations. The eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. So if verses 3 through 5 described God's power, verse 5 now describes his eternity, and how even the eternal mountains flee from before God and his everlasting ways. So here is God's... God arises, God approaches, God takes stock. This is God's awareness, I'll just put it that way. When he measures, when he looks around, there is the clear indication that he is in control of this situation, and that he will be the determining factor in it. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains of the land of Midian tremble. These would be the regions of Northeast Africa, and then of the area around where God arises, where the Midians lived, and all of their tents and all of their lives shook before God's approach. Now, verse 8, and parts of this I should mention to us are I'm told, are among the most difficult passages in the Bible to translate. In verses 8 and 9, and especially 9, you'll notice the variations in translations. I read that in verse 9, there's at least 100 different efforts to translate it. So be aware of that. And then notice he says, was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers, or your indignation against the sea when you rode on your horses on your chariot of salvation? What event comes to your mind in verse 8 when God... when the waters, either rivers or seas, are helpless before his wrath, his anger, and his indignation. His chariot of salvation, what event does that bring to your mind? All right, the parting of the Red Sea, the Exodus, the deliverance of God's people. And it stood for the power of Egypt as well. In verse 7, they tremble in affliction. In verse 8, God's people are delivered by what? They're delivered by his wrath, his anger, and his indignation. Do you notice that? Verse 8 describes God's judgment of not the Babylonians, but of a previous world power, which was Egypt. And how God's action in judging that nation was actually his chariot of salvation for his people. What Habakkuk is doing is finding his footing by looking toward the future with his feet firmly planted in what God has done in the past. And that's an important exercise for all of us. You strip the sheath from your bow, calling for many arrows. You split the earth with rivers. A lot of the versions will focus on the idea that what God's arrows were guided by his word or something to that effect. And all of that is true, but the point would be God worked his will. God worked his way. God acted in behalf of his people. Let me just put it up like this. So God's action, I'm not putting the verses here because we're reading them as we go along, but you can see this is developing. This is a story that develops in Habakkuk's memory here as he recounts God's work in the past. And it shows, if you look back up, the heavens in verse 3, then the earth in verse 6, and then the mountains, and then the tents of the people, and then the rivers, and then the sea, and now the earth being split. God's power is evidenced in all of creation in this way. Takes the strongest, most awesome things about the world that he can imagine and uses them to say, God was so mighty that these were either shaken, split, or helpless before him. Verse 10, the mountains saw you and writhed. The raging waters swept on. The deep, here would be the deep ocean, gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. And now the heavens are included. The sun and the moon stood still in their place at the light of your arrows as they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear. You marched through the earth in fury. You threshed the nations in anger. And now here's the point, verse 13. You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. This is about as impressive a poetical way of using the natural world, the things that people can see, in order to try to illustrate the power of what we can't see, and that's God's active and gracious will in behalf of his own people. How would you describe what God has done to try to have a people and to try to save a people and try to be with his people? How could you describe it? Well, one way is to use the natural elements as illustrations and try to show God's use of all of these things, but then all of them being either moved to raise their hands on high, verse 10, or to stand still, or to be shaken, or however he says it. All of it is a way of saying, look what God has done. If all of verses 3 through 12 describe God's going out or God's coming, but then verse 13 describes God's achievement. And what God's achievement is the salvation of his people. Now, looking back on what happened with the Exodus and the crossing of the sea, when finally the waters, the threshing waters settled back over the sea, what have they covered? The whole Egyptian army, all right, the chariot, all of that kind of stuff. What have they gained? Well, God has gained a people who are delivered from their enemies. He takes them to Sinai and enters into a covenant with them and tells them that If they will hear, if they will obey his voice, then they'll be his treasured possessions out of all the nations of the earth, or treasured possession out of all the nations. That's Exodus 19 in verses 5 and 6. Verse 13 should be read in light of Exodus chapters 14 and 15. The crossing of the sea, and then the song of rejoicing that Miriam has in Exodus 15. There are three phrases, two or three phrases here that we need to think about in verse 13. First, what is salvation? I mean, in the most literal sense, what is salvation? What? Deliverance. It's just deliverance. It can be deliverance from danger. It can be deliverance from death. It can be deliverance from an enemy. It can be deliverance from a circumstance. But it's just deliverance. With regard to sin and evil, it means rescue from that. It means being saved. In that way, we'd say it. Now, what about your people? What does that phrase mean? It's chosen. All right. So, in a real way, the earth and all that's in it belongs to God. In a real way, God made all people in his image and wants all of us to be saved. But your people are the ones, these are the ones you have acted to save or to rescue. These are the ones that you've extended your promises to, the ones you have anointed and chosen in order to work your will. What about the word anointed in that passage? What does that word indicate? All right, this is a set apart. Anointing with oil means this is the one God then anointed these chosen instruments of his to be his people. What ultimately becomes the meaning of the word anointed if it's anointed one? In Old Testament, prophets, priests, and kings were anointed. Who becomes the anointed one, and what's the word by which we know that? Christ. All right. Christ becomes, the Messiah becomes the anointed one. Now, real quickly here, you crush the head of the house of the wicked. Romans 16, verse 20, right in there, I think of when I read this, you crush the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. That's the way the ESV translates it. And it says that this line is uncertain. But the idea, the concept is, in the last part of verse 13, God won a victory over the wicked. And it was a devastating blow, which was final. You pierced with his own arrows the heads of his warriors. And I think if you think of the crossing of the sea with that, it makes sense. Who came like a whirlwind to scatter me. I noticed that most of the recent translations translated us, to scatter us. The personal pronoun plural enters the picture. Rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. The idea meaning that those who came in order to destroy God's people fall, and then they're rejoiced over. You trampled the sea with your horses, the surging of mighty waters. And in this picture, God's chariot of salvation and his own arrows, and then his trampling with his own horses are, of course, all figurative. But if you can imagine the water closing back in over the chariots of the Egyptians, and then just sort of surging or gurgling over that defeated army. If you can hear the sound of that in your mind, then you get Habakkuk's poetry in this passage. One of our problems in trying to cope with God's work in the world providentially is taking for granted the victories God's won in the past. We've heard the stories. I mean, you can read the narrative of the defeat of the Egyptians, for example, and assign the narrative story of that to a children's Bible class and leave it there. It is meant to be taken like Habakkuk describes it here. This is the mighty act of a living God in behalf of a nation of slaves who, if they protest, just have to make the same amount of bricks without straw. It's a terror. That was an unbelievable or an awesome act of deliverance and victory. That when people went to Egypt, there are 70 souls, and they end up staying there for 400 years plus, and they come out of a situation where their own children, the male children, are killed, and now they win a victory like this, or God wins a victory like this. You don't hear stories like that. There's no victories like that. It looks impossible. But Habakkuk has learned the only way for me to process what's going on now and what God says He's about to do is to be more impressed with what He's done before than I have been recently. Does that make sense to you? Do you see kind of the role this chapter plays? Before Habakkuk is ready to pray the prayer at the end of, which is verses 16 and following, it's remarkable. Before he gets to the ready for that, he needs this recounting of what God has done to tell his story. And we'll come back to this last verse next week. I hear, in other words, I hear, look, verse 2 said, I've heard the report of you and of your work. Verse 16 says, I hear, and my body trembles, and my lips quiver at the sound, and rottenness enters into my bones, and my legs tremble beneath me. Yet, and we'll start next week, I will wait, I will quietly wait for the day of trouble. Verse 16, first part of that verse, is the experience of people who have found themselves in the presence of God throughout history. We want to talk about being close to God and seeing His glory as if that were a comfortable thing. What did people do in the Bible? What did Moses do when he found himself in God's presence in Exodus 33? What? He fell on his face. What did Isaiah do in Isaiah 6 when he saw God's holiness? Woe is me, I'm undone. I'm coming apart. In Daniel 10, what does Daniel do? The Spirit leaves him, he falls like a dead man. In Revelation 1, when John sees Christ high and lifted up in His glory, what does John do? Falls on his face like a dead man. I see a theme there. What does Habakkuk do here when he hears God about God's work? My body trembles, my lips quiver, rottenness enters my bones, my legs tremble beneath me. You see, there one thing that we can do to cope with current or future circumstances is to be more in awe of what God's done before. So this week, choose a story that you heard in class growing up and go back and think about that and stand in awe of it a little bit more. Think about what really happened. Use one of the stories from Daniel, or use 2 Chronicles 20 in the days of Jehoshaphat, or use this story from Exodus chapters 14 and 15. But think about God's victories, and then think about the resurrection of Christ after that, and the impact that it had on the guards and then on the people. And you kind of will get this prophet's story, I think. Thank you guys so much for being with us today. And go back and reread the beautiful poetry of Habakkuk 3 and use our A's here to follow the process of it. Hope everybody has a good week this week.